The Cold Omaha Podcast Network.
You can put it on the board.
Woo!
All right, we're back here for another episode of the Midwest Swing Podcast. You can find us on Twitter at Midwest Swing Pod. We're part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network. You can find Cold Omaha and Zone Coverage all under one roof on Twitter at Zone Coverage MN. I am your host, Brandon Warren. You can find me on Twitter at Brandon _ Warren. And I am joined, as always, by Tom Schreier at TSchreier3, running the board today. Tom, what's going on?
Not too much. I thought we had a good Cold Omaha pod, which we talked a lot about the Twins, actually.
Yeah, actually, you check out the staff pod. That'll be up later today. So will this. Fun show. Twins coming back home here for a six-game home stretch against Oakland and against Boston. Chased away the weather. Yesterday was the last of about a week of icky weather. So we are going to bring in Mike Berardino of the St. Paul Pioneer Press. Mike was off chasing the Twins on the road where the weather was considerably nicer. And Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing very well, guys. I must correct you, though. The weather in Kansas City,
oh,
not
true.
Nice.
That's fair. That's fair. We had snow here, which was really bad. And then, So the Twins have dominated Kansas City so far this season. Obviously, Kansas City off to a rough start, losing twice as often as they've won. Is this a team just in disarray right now?
The Royals, I think sometimes when you try to prop open a competitive window for one extra year, and everybody knows that it's the final year before the gang may have to be broken up fully, I don't think you can overlook the impact that might have on a group. And those guys achieved quite a bit. They carried the Royals from irrelevance to a championship, and people thought that they had a little longer window, but now the national stories and just your natural intuition would tell you that they're on the way to being sellers in July. I think the Indians taking that big step forward last year finally impacts it a little bit. And then, they do not have the endless payroll to work with in Kansas City that a team owned by Walmart family members should.
Well, and, you look at this rotation right now, and boy, wouldn't Sean Manaea and Brandon Finnegan look better in it. Those are two players traded for, respectively, Johnny Cueto and Ben Zobrist. But you probably don't win the World Series.
You cannot. It's not. I hate that reasoning. I hope you're not siding with that kind of thing. Always protect the prospect because you have a chance to go for it. You have a chance to win rings. Even if you fall short, you do it.
Yeah.
And the Texas Rangers, as I wrote recently, have had to send a number of impressive arms out the door in the pursuit of a championship that they never quite got there. They're very close. David Freese had other ideas. But when you have a window, certainly you want to limit the talent of the player going out the door, but you have to make fair deals along the way. And with the Cueto and Zobrist, as you mentioned, they don't do what they did without them.
No, absolutely, and that's what I think. I meant that I think there are probably fans, Royals fans out there, whether it's on Twitter or just in Missouri, that are thinking, man, it would be great to have these guys instead.
Well, I think I'm guessing, Brandon, that those people also might have been part of the 700,000 or whatever it was that overtook the plaza for that victory parade a couple years ago and ended a 30-year drought. So that's in the big picture, Dayton Moore and his people were absolutely right to target those guys, to get those guys, and to give up pieces of their future for it. The problem, I think, maybe the bigger problem might be with the Royals. One of the problems is if you're going to extend your competitive window, you need to keep priming the pump and you need to keep having draft and development side feed you with talent. And the latest guy to come up is Jorge Bonifacio, and he, you know, he may be very good eventually, but he made a costly error on a Kepler line drive in that series. And I think Hunter Dozier's not done what they've wanted so far, and there have been others. Danny Duffy, certainly on the prior side, has done everything you could ask, and obviously a mostly homegrown team. But there may be a little interruption in that flow based on the fact they've been much better in the last few years, and they have not been drafting as high.
Well, you get the sense they're going to have to pick and choose who they can and cannot keep. They've already made one of those decisions by signing Danny Duffy to an extension. I kind of feel like maybe Mike Moustakas should be the other guy that they choose. Hosmer might be the sentimental choice, but a first baseman who hits the ball on the ground a bunch and is probably going to be overpaid in free agency makes that a tough pill to swallow. They also did make the decision to keep Alex Gordon around too, which has not panned out, probably thanks in large part to the Moustakas collision last year in Chicago. But I feel like that makes it difficult for them to keep Lorenzo Cain. I think Alcides Escobar has got one foot out the door with Raul Mondesi hopefully taking over at short. But I feel like, yeah, they're going to have to really pick and choose and be kind of picky about who they're going to keep moving into next year. And I feel like Moustakas should be that guy.
Yeah, I don't know that I would disagree, but he too has been streaky throughout his career. Hosmer's a tough case because Scott Boras will always find a way to get whatever the top dollar is, and then beyond even the people could have imagined, he'll find a market for him. But that's a little dangerous because he's not performing like a $15 to $18 million a year guy, and that may be what they're looking for. I'm not fully versed on what that market might bear, but you know, I do think they have with Kelvin Herrera, they have a chance to impact pennant races elsewhere if they don't snap back to life. All you have to remember was just a couple years ago that the 14 Royals were kind of buried in July. They were just going nowhere, and then they caught fire and end up all the way in Game 7 of the World Series. But not sure that happens again. I did tweet something while we were there that you look at Wade Davis and Greg Holland, who were out the door, one by free agency, one by trade, and they've been virtually perfect in their new homes of Colorado for Holland and the Cubs for Davis, and Jorge Soler. So far, they can't get him on the field. So
anyway, on to the local nine here, getting ready to start a three-game set against Oakland. 12-11 to wrap up April. Obviously, some things that are surprising, some things that are not surprising, I want to ask you about as we kind of recap that first month. First of all, we'll kind of go a little off the grid. What went to plan as far as you're concerned, or you know, what did not surprise you about this start?
Well, Irvin Santana has been better than anybody could have expected, but it's not a surprise that he's been good because that goes back to the middle of last June. So he's just carried that over. Brandon Kinsler being good hasn't surprised me. I know some people may have had doubts that there was something fluky about it last year, but that 62% ground ball rate for his career was highly encouraging, and he's maintained that. So, you know, we're talking about a guy now who's, 24 for 27 in save situations since taking over. That's not the only way to look at it, but it's not like he's been a problem at all going back to mid-June of last year. I think Sano has been Sano hitting like this is a surprise. I'd say Sano's, I don't know. I mean, when you go 12-11 after starting the way they did, Brandon, it's hard to come up with things that you can say, you know, dead to rights you expected. Mm-hmm. I think Kepler's been about what I expected so far. I don't think he's been above or below what was fair to expect.
Whose defensive start do you think is more sustainable, Miguel Sano or Jorge Polanco?
Well, I do think Sano has the ability with that arm to impact games defensively, and he's moving better. And, you know, as long as he stays in this kind of shape, and he seems to, I mean, I think it struck me the other day when he did a post-game interview without his shirt on, because usually he's wearing a shirt. I think the baby fat, I think, you know, at some point young players can grow out of baby fat. And there was some of that. He's always going to be very big, but he's pretty cut now in the upper body, especially. He's got, you know, ham hock thighs. He's got offensive guard thighs, but those are strong. The upper body is all muscle now, and that's not good for opponents. And every minute he steps between the lines, he feels really good about himself and what he can do to impact games. Polanco has, a number of times those throws have had to be one-hop throws that Maurer has scooped and saved some errors. There have been some high throws as well. I think there will be a stretch this year, maybe a couple of stretches, where Jorge sees the errors pile up on him and he'll have to fight his defensive confidence and try to lift that. But so I guess my answer would be Sano is the one that I think can maintain this.
Yeah, you got to say that Polanco gets by with a little help from his friends. For Miguel Sano, I feel like the leadership is evolving a little bit for him as well. Obviously, it's tough for a guy who's in his age 24 season to really be a leader in a clubhouse with a player 10 years older than him and Joe Maurer, who's been there, you know, since Sano was just a young boy, back growing up. But do you get the sense that Sano is evolving as one of these clubhouse guys and on-field guys that can take a key leadership role sooner rather than later?
Yeah, I suppose. I think especially within the Latin side of the clubhouse that you see it. I mean, I've noticed him trying to prop up Danny Santana, for instance, and spending some time with him in the clubhouse because he's not getting to play very much and his time with the Twins is in jeopardy. Although I could see him clearing waivers when Adrianza comes back and maybe being outrighted to AAA. But, I also think that Sano has done a fine job this year of keeping his ears open when Irvin Santana is talking to those guys, and they're not translating those conversations for us, but there's a lot of laughter over there, and then it seems like a good group, obviously, and it's just one of the facts of life in a major league clubhouse is that sometimes you're going to have groups split apart and speak in their native tongue, and it's I don't think that's a bad thing. I've seen that in plenty of winning clubhouses along the way, where it doesn't mean it happens at the exclusion of mixing with those who aren't fluent in Spanish, but I'm sure it's comforting to them, and that's that happened a little bit more on a road trip.
Joe Maurer coming off the worst April of his career. You wrote about that for the Pioneer Press. People should definitely check that out.
I read it and enjoyed it.
Yep. Over the last.
Well, thank you, Tom. Thank you.
Over the last day or so, good quote from Robbie Grossman saying he doesn't think there's too many guys on the team hitting the ball better than him. He's just hitting rockets right at people. It's part of the shift. Lots of good quotes, lots of good stuff there, Mike. Do you get the sense that Maurer's maybe just on the verge of getting ready to break out? Virtually no strikeouts in April, so he's putting the ball in play. The shift has taken a little bit of fire out of him, but he did pull a double, I think it was, to score the pivotal runs in the first game of the Royals series. And, I think there's signs that he's getting ready to come out of his shell, but do you agree with that, or do you think he's, the ceiling is continuing to kind of decline for him?
No, I think that his, he's always pretty much going to be very poised about it, and he's certainly not going to panic, and if he does panic, it's not going to be public panic. But I don't see a loss of bat speed as evidenced by the great lack of swing and miss and Maul set out. The numbers support it. The one number, and I mentioned this to Joe too, to see what he thought. But not only is his career strikeout rate been cut in half here in the first month, but the walk rate also cut in half, because those are typically right around 12-13%, both of them, and now they're both around 6-7%. And I wondered if that was maybe because we're seeing more early count contact from Joe, and he's swinging at the first pitch, I believe now 10% of the time. That's climbed over the last couple of years, which I know it drives fans crazy that he always takes strike one right down the middle, and so much of the modern game, that might be the best pitch that you see in the at-bat, especially against relievers with put-away breaking stuff. But he's trying to evolve with that, and I don't think he necessarily had any eye-opening thoughts on why his walk rate has been cut in half, but I do think that's something else to monitor because he has been rung up a number of times here early on where he didn't like the call. But you know, we're in the pitch FX era, and we're in an era where umpires aren't allowed, in theory, to have their own zones, and they're not supposed to tailor those zones to the reputation of the player. And I don't think you can divorce that from the fact that Joe Mauer's walk rate isn't what it was. I think that a strike should be a strike now, and that wasn't necessarily the way it was in the first half of his career.
What do you make of Brian Dozier's slow start? Obviously not as slow as it was last year, but people aren't really talking about it, and maybe that's just because there's an expectation that he'll turn it around or that it hasn't been, you know, excruciatingly slow as last year. But it looks like another guy that probably is just a couple swings away from getting out of it, in my opinion.
Doesn't feel like he's searching necessarily. We're not seeing those balls in the air carry, obviously. We're not even seeing necessarily warning track outs very often. We're seeing some lazy fly balls, too. I would think that he's definitely a streaky hitter. We know that. And it was going to be pretty hard to carry that second half right on into this year, but I do think he's healthy. I think that knee scare was something that certainly threw him for a loop, and maybe that week after there was some concern, but I think he's moving well enough now. I do think that sometimes defensively some balls are eluding him. Maybe this is part of the evolution of the way they're shifting, but you know, some balls that he would get to traditionally are slipping under his glove, and in some cases they've been pretty significant, but and he's made a couple errors, but with the bat, I don't think there's a lack of bat speed or anything. I don't notice people you know, flummoxing him with the way they're pitching him, but when I do know that when the home runs start, they will come in a flurry.
Have you heard anything about Miguel Sano's suspension hearing?
No, and I'm off today, so I'm not checking on it, but I would have to think, because I was told last Monday when it was first announced that these things traditionally happen within a 10-day period, they make every effort to do that. So it wouldn't surprise me if today was the day that that was taken care of, or Monday was taken. I mean, I just don't know. I don't know the latest, but I mean, sure. I'm thinking by the middle of this week, they should have taken care of it.
So Byron Buxton, you know, his numbers on the surface are not going to make anybody who's not paying close attention, you know, take notice, still hitting under 150 on base, just around 250, and not a ton of slugging percentage. But obviously had a much better road trip in terms of not striking out, taking a bunch of walks, up to 9 on the season now. You had a good tweet about when he had his 9th one last year. Do you think that he's kind of on the verge of a breakout here? Because I really think now that he's tracking pitches better, you know, he's going to start driving the balls into the gaps and maybe finding the seats with a couple as well.
Well, as I receive a package from UPS here,
nice.
I think that that was a very encouraging road trip for Buxton. It was overshadowed by Sano's all-world road trip, but you could see. I mean, I did started with the first game in Texas when Byron, I believe, had 4 plate appearances and saw 23 pitches, and I mentioned that to him after the game, and he wasn't aware of that, but I think he could tell that his idea of tracking the ball, letting it travel more, really working to stay in the strike zone, was paying some dividends. And he's worked very hard with James Rousen and Rudy Hernandez on that in the cage. And it's not just the swing path, but so much of it is swing recognition. If you swing at strikes and take balls, no matter who you are, you'll have better chance of success. So that really started to change on that road trip, starting in Texas. And some of those walks, you know, it's not like there were walks in an eighth inning of a 9-1 game or something. A couple of them were vital. They set up winning rallies. So he feels better about things, and Twins feel better about it. And you don't hear, even though the numbers are still very, very modest, you're not going to hear that speculation right now again, I don't think, about an emotion, because he's just fine at the bottom of the order, and they're going to give him time to climb out of that big hole that he dug.
Do you think there's any chance with maybe a week or 10 days of fairly solid production, he could creep up to maybe 7 or 8 in the lineup? Or do you think he's in the 9 spot now until he really gets swinging well?
You know, after what he experienced in the number 3 hole, and I asked him about that before the story that I wrote going into Sunday. That was our Sunday feature, because the latest is at the turning point for Byron Buxton. Maybe this time it is. But I do think that putting him number 3 hole subconsciously led to too much pull happiness and too much air action for him, and he just got out of whack. And part of it, he said, was he was basically overwhelmed with the need to drive people in. I guess he was if something needed to be done with people on base, he felt he had to do it, and he was just overwhelming himself with that pressure. Now, doesn't mean in a 9 hole that you're not going to have people on base. It can happen just as much. But maybe if he feels, oh, I'm a 9 hitter, not a 3 hitter, I just have to do my part. If anything I do is gravy, just put the ball in play, take a walk, whatever. And I also like what he's doing once he is getting on now. Now we're starting to see the very immediate stolen base component that he can bring, and he's showing a little less fear of being caught, because it's going to be very hard to catch him. So I don't think they're going, Brandon, I don't think they're going to mess with moving him up in that lineup in the short term, because for one thing, there aren't others that deserve to hit behind him. And secondly, just let him keep making these incremental gains and see where it takes him.
One of his bottom third cohorts is Eddie Rosario. I think Rosario has been taking some better plate appearances lately too. Maybe you could point to that home run off of the Detroit Tigers reliever Joe Jimenez, his teammate in the World Baseball Classic. Have you seen improvement from him lately like I have?
I've seen it from the beginning, really, for the most part, staying in the zone in an un-Eddie-like way. And, yes, he's definitely been working to hit the ball to the opposite field with authority, not slapping it, but driving it. And it doesn't mean that every time he hits the ball, it's going to go out to left field, but at least he's opened up the whole field to himself, and he's not pulling off the ball, and he's seeing the ball a little longer, all the things that are pretty much universal and why you would want to be a threat all field. He does have enough power to take the ball out the other way. He's showing that, and that's actually when he's at his best, Mulder believes, is when he's driving the ball the other way. So that's how you start piling up a double-digit game hit streak, and that's how you just – you know, work counts a little bit more. He's always going to be an aggressive hitter, but he has found ways to be, I guess, aggressively smart, and he's doing that, and that's been very helpful.
And obviously, Irvin Santana has been the number one with the bullet star for this rotation, but you can't sleep on what Hector Santiago has been capable of. Currently away from the team, tending to a family matter, but should be maybe back in the clubhouse as early as today. How impressed have you been with him? Especially for me, the changeup has looked really good. Command, very, very good. Still got a fair number of strikeouts, but he just seems to be this guy at 29 that pitches like a 35-year-old, 15-year MLB veteran in terms of moving the ball in and out of the strike zone, giving guys different looks, and mixing in 5-6 different pitches. You never really know what you're going to get with him at the plate, and so far it's been a really good start.
Yeah, I mean, there is more life on the fastball, it seems, and he does prefer to pitch off the fastball quite a bit. He's got that screwball that he's featuring more, and that is giving right-handed hitters some trouble. One thing, though, is that, you know, we've known since we were aware of him that he was not going to be a guy that modern analytics favored, and that right. He will put people on base, and he will pitch in and out of trouble, and he had been very efficient until that Texas start, and then it was kind of vintage Hector. But I looked at the deserved run average for the Twins over the weekend when we were in Kansas City, probably during that rain delay, and I was a bit alarmed by Hector's DRA, which is maybe you can explain to your listeners more efficiently than I would what it is, but basically it tries to factor every bit of luck and even pitch framing into what your ERA should be and what you're pitching to. You know, if all the baseball gods were fully fair to everyone, and his is 7.27.
Whoa.
So that's a little, that's a big gap. And keep in mind that Kyle Gibson, as much as he has struggled, is 6.33. So, and Phil Hughes is 6.28. So I'm not so sure that Hector's April is sustainable, but he doesn't have to be that good to still be very useful.
Compared to maybe where you would have been in the off season, as opposed to now, do you think there's any chance he's a Twin pass this season?
I've not thought that all along because in this market, any pitching free agent market is going to see overpays, and, mm-hmm. and he now has a bit of a track record and a great reputation deservedly for the off-field stuff and the, what he can bring, whatever a pitcher can bring to a staff. But, you know, the times he's not throwing the ball, he's going to bring those things. He's a great guy, and teammates love him, and he's been around winning, and he's left-handed, and I would be kind of stunned if he found it became affordable somehow for teams this offseason if he maintains this. Now, if he regresses to his DRA, then that's another story. But
sure.
The Twins would like to think that they have some other arms coming, and they don't want to block those. But I do think that he'll be – I don't know, let's see where they are in the standings in July, because obviously if they're hanging around 500, they're going to be tempted to keep him. But I think they're going to get plenty of calls on him. That's a tough one. It really very fluid because, you know, that's I think what he did out of the bullpen was eye-opening. He's not going to be a reliever, but just his competitive fire and all that was on display in the WBC, and people who might have been kind of lukewarm on him on other teams and other front offices might have had their eyes open to that a little bit because maybe he would be okay in a pennant race. But long way to go till July, and certainly even longer to go to the off season. But I would like to think, I'm sure the Twins would like to think, that by then Berríos will be more of a known quantity and a written in pen for next year's rotation. But there could be some turnover, no doubt about that. I mean, I would have thought Steven Gonsalves would have been knocking on the door strongly by midseason as well, but he's had his injury concerns with that shoulder now multiple times, so I don't think you can talk in those terms for him. Hard to say.
So you have teased the Twins wanting to get some younger guys up here eventually. I feel like Saturday is a good opportunity for them to bring Jose Berríos up. He's been just phenomenal. Down at AAA Rochester, I do think another option could be Nick Tepish, though he has not thrown out of the bullpen yet with the Twins while he's been up. How would you handicap that, or what do you think is likely versus what could also happen?
Well, all I can say is I asked Molitor about the, you know, where Tepish fell in all of that. If he was a candidate, he said he's a candidate, but you know, if we don't get him into a game, this is on Sunday morning, we don't get him into a game here soon, it's going to be 16 days between outings,
right.
Much less starts. That's just crazy. Tepish is a veteran, but come on. And it's the Boston Red Sox he'd be facing. That also, I think, mitigates the Red Sox being the opponent, mitigates against Berríos getting the call up there because they're going to want a soft landing for him whenever they bring him up. I also have reason to believe that no one from the higher up aspect of the front office, type of high-end officials that typically would be in there to watch Berríos before his previous call-ups was on hand on Sunday when he threw again so well and seized his second International League Player of the Week and third overall. That doesn't mean they're not going to call him up on Saturday, but I don't think that was plan A. So they're in a weird spot there. I think when they sent him out after that spring where they barely saw him, I don't think they were thinking it was just going to be 4 weeks before they'd recall him. But he's forcing their hand, which is what he's supposed to do. I do think we'll see him sooner than later, but it might have to wait until the middle of May or even late May. That said, they'll probably call him up immediately.
Do you think Edelberto Mejia's in that mix, or is he just not lined up or not ready to get back? Because I think it will be 10 days, so he will be eligible.
Yes, it's possible as well because I believe he's due to start on Thursday. I think that's right. So they could easily bump him back two more.
Mm-hmm.
That's a possibility. Maybe a better solution even than Tepish on 16 days between starts, 15 days of rest, which is just crazy, and even better than putting Berríos in there against a Red Sox team that hasn't been tearing the cover off the ball, but certainly is known to do so. So, that might be where it has to go. and they carved that situation out because of Mejia's inconsistencies. But when he went down, he did what he was supposed to do. He was more efficient. But again, the gap between AAA and the major leagues for a pitcher might be the hardest thing to navigate when you're in a player development or front office situation. When is the right time to call those guys up? When can you trust the numbers and the dominance? And when do you take it, at arm's length? And I think fastball command is going to be far and away the most important factor for Berríos. And the problem is that he can seemingly show fastball command at AAA and has on each of his four assignments now in AAA. And, it seems like pitches that he gets called down there, the Molitor has said as much, pitches that get called down there as strikes, borderline strikes, are not being called for him up here. We've already alluded to the fact that a strike should be a strike in the majors, and that's how they've set it up. Maybe Castro being here and Jimenez will help this year, because it was painful to watch last year when he would repeatedly fall behind 2-0 and then have to come in. And, you know, that's the great equalizer if the hitter can eliminate pitches, because he does have every pitch in the arsenal that he should. It's just a matter of refinement. And then it's a matter of working ahead in the count and setting you up. He checks so many boxes, but the poise and the fastball command are the final two, and it'll be so important to make sure that before he's brought back that the Twins have not just a reasonable expectation that he'll check those boxes this time, but be virtually certain.
I feel like it's a tough point to reconcile between media and fans, especially the casual fan. But I think, and you can tell me if you agree or disagree, there's got to be a certain level of respect for the way that Phil Hughes has gutted out his first five starts, 26.2 innings. Again, the results aren't particularly good, but he's just, I feel like, gutted it out to the point where he's giving you about all you could expect from him right now as he's working through some early season stuff. Where do you stand on that?
You're on the side of Phil Hughes is gutting it out, and you want me to say he's not gutting it out?
No, I have a lot of respect for how he's going about his business, trying to reinvent himself on the fly. And I don't think fans will look at the $13 million salary and say, what do you mean gutting it out? He should be on the disabled list, or he should be just doing whatever he's supposed to do. I think he's doing a phenomenal job reinventing on the fly. And I know he doesn't like the phrase reinventing, but the guy's throwing completely different pitches right now than he was a year ago.
Yeah, there was just that one game, the home game against Cleveland, where he got away from the plan and wouldn't throw his changeup because he couldn't get a feel for it. But he went back to it again in Texas. He is, you're right, Brandon, and I know you're not just saying that because he did your podcast. He's he's a 30-year-old who's having to pitch as a finesse right-hander, and it's an odd thing to see for a guy who should be in his prime. But he has had to set his ego aside, which is not a problem because he's always been self-deprecating and really, I think, self-aware and would never pretend that he's something he's not. 95 up in the zone is not coming back for Phil Hughes. I think we know that. I'm not sure 93 is coming back unless he gets to pitch in Seattle, where they always juice the gun and he likes it out in Seattle. But he is learning to survive by mixing it up. He's not exactly a junk baller, but he has to keep you guessing, and his catchers have done a very nice job of working him through those. The sequencing is so vital to him. It's vital to anyone, but especially if you're not going to have swing and miss stuff. He got 10 swings and misses when we were in Detroit that was just a marvel when he did not have big stuff that day. Mm-hmm. He's just not going to have it, but he wasn't even that sharp necessarily, but just the sequencing of it could tie up hitters who are trying to think along with the pitcher and the catcher. So, there were times when he would throw 93, 94, when we'd see in the previous years, even in his great year of 2014, when he might give up 20 to 25 foul balls in a game. It was sometimes Pelfrey-like, and because it lacks the late movement, I guess, a little straighter with the fastball. And he was predictable. You know, it would be fastball cutter mostly, and the occasional curveball they got him to work in there. But now with the changeup and velocities that are pretty much 89 to 90 at best, touching 91, you can see he's if not energized by the process, because he's so calm, certainly he's challenged by it, and he's determined. And I think, you know, Neil Allen's excited by the fact that some of these adjustments are starting to take, and we'll see. He might be able to to consistently do this. Can he do it for, you know, the final 3 years of his contract here and keep things in line? I'm not sure. He's sitting on 5 ERA right now, so I don't know that we can assign him any early season awards, but gutting it out is probably the right phrase.
And this is the last thing I got for you before we let you go. Brandon Kinstler has been very sturdy and steady at the back of the bullpen. You know, the nerdier statistics might not like him because he's walked some guys, not a lot of strikeouts. And you and I can fight over the mom spaghetti moniker, but I'll happily concede that to you. How do you see?
Well, you don't have to. Let me just say, the last thing I want to do is co-opt something that came from you. I'm not sure. I haven't gone back and done all the research. But if you feel strongly that you were on that first, and I just subconsciously plagiarized you, I will apologize here. But I'm not sure. I'm really not sure.
We'll have to check
the tape.
Things
are moving too fast, Brandon.
We'll have to check the tape.
But the last thing I want to do is steal your thunder because you deserve it.
I got a lot of it.
Maybe I will. How about you can do hashtag mom spaghetti, and I will, when he comes in, continue what I trotted out on Sunday, ma spaghetti.
I like it.
I think I'm mixing up, you know, two classic moments in pop culture, and it makes me feel better.
Step Brothers, right?
Yes.
Okay, well, we'll take it. So he's obviously been steady at the back end, but I think the rest of the bullpen is in flux a little bit. Matt Belisle had the rough outing in Texas. Ryan Pressly has been up and down. Good secondary stuff, but given up some home runs. Taylor Rogers here and there has struggled with command a little bit. And then, you know, the rest of it is basically Tyler Duffy has been what everyone could have expected and then some. But how do you see this bullpen lining up behind Kinstler as we head into this homestand if – I still think they trust Belisle in the eighth inning, but what do you see the totem pole looking like for Paul Molitor starting if there was to be a tight lead to protect tonight against the A's?
Well, I think it's still pretty fluid, and it may remain that way for some time to come until Pressly is fully beyond his hiccup. He certainly showed signs on this road trip of being past it, and he said all the right things when I talked to him about it. You know, admitting, I think the first step to moving beyond a crisis of confidence is admitting that you had one. I think that's for any problem. And he did. I mean, it kind of was jarring to him. They were opposite field homers, but it was still jarring to him that somebody with can touch 97, 98 and have a 90-plus slider could be taken out of the yard. So he seems to have corrected some of that. There was nothing mechanical about it. There was not even really necessarily anything sequential. I do think he needs to pitch inside more, and that's been said by his coaches and by his manager, but he needs to make people uncomfortable. A good way to do that is 97 inside. Doesn't have to be at the head. But I think Pressly is the eighth inning guy as soon as they feel that he's fully ramped up and beyond his little crisis of confidence, and I think we're pretty close to that. Belisle, there's another guy who's gutting it out. I mean, that is none of that pitch mix is going to wow anyone, but he tends to know in his career he's shown that for one thing he doesn't back down from anybody. For another, he will outthink you, and he will execute with what he has and put it where he needs to put it. But it doesn't mean that he's always going to get outs. He was really better than he had a right to expect last year with the Nationals, and pretty good for the Cardinals. And we'll see how far this can go into the year with him being an eighth inning or even important seventh inning guy, but he's also gutting it out, it seems.
Well, he's Mike Berardino. He's St. Paul Pioneer Press Twins beat reporter. Hopefully we'll see you out at Target Field sometime in the next 6 days before they head out on the road. How does that sound?
That's probably going to happen.
Good.
There's a good chance of that, yes.
Well, and we'll try to get you on here with my brother Cody, your number one fan on Twitter here in the next few weeks, because I know he'd love to not only meet you but get on the show with you.
That would be delightful. Let's make that happen.
So he's Mike Berardino. We got Tom Schreier working the keys. I'm Brandon Warren. You've been listening to Midwest Swing, part of the Cold Omaha Podcast Network.